And there's nothing round the bend except those golden tones of going home again. Going home.
Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. It's July 2nd, the second day of the month. It seems longer, doesn't it? It's very nice to have you with us, and we have quite a discussion planned. I'll introduce our panelists in just a moment. As always, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear from you this morning. Anything, we have a lot to talk about. There's a lot going on in the news, and we expect a lot of letters, so please keep them brief and to the point. We'll get to as many as we possibly can. They're already rolling in, so that's how I usually know that it's going to be a busy morning. Let me introduce our panel, and we'll get started. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, Jim Henler. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm okay. You know, today is National Anisette Day. And I have a feeling strong alcohol is much needed for many of us. So it's a perfect timing.
I didn't read it, and I don't even know why I didn't read it, but we got a letter, I think it was on Friday right after the debate, that it was, I think, because we went late. And at about 10:50, the letter writer said, I really think for today's show and today's show only that day drinking should be allowed. And Yeah. And my reply was going to be, how do you know it happened? But, yes, good point. We also welcome former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain to the proceedings. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. I'm happy to be here and a lot to talk about.
A lot to talk about, indeed. We'll also be welcoming Heather Mulligan, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, who will be here at some point. All right. Let's go. I don't know. Let's go to the news of the day. So, you know, look, these are all stories that we've talked about and we'll continue to talk about. Yesterday, as we were doing the show, the Supreme Court came out with its immunity ruling. We were doing our best in the 20 to 30 minutes that we were on the air together to cobble together some of the facts that were leaking out, slowly dripping out, I should say, from the Supreme Court. They were reading it aloud, so that was making it a little more difficult to figure out in real time of what was happening. But here we go. We know now, and we have much more insight into the decision, the Supreme Court's decision, to bestow presidents with immunity from prosecution over official actions is an extraordinary expansion of executive power that will reverberate long after Donald Trump is gone. But its immediate implications for the election subversion case against Mr. Trump and the prospect that he may feel less constrained by law if he returns to power. The ruling also adds to the nearly relentless rise of presidential power since the mid-20th century. It had seemed like a constitutional truism in recent years when more than one lower court opinion addressing novel legal issues raised by Mr. Trump's norm-breaking behavior observed that presidents are not kings. But suddenly, they do enjoy a kind of prerogative of a monarch. The relationship between the president and the people he serves has shifted, says Justice Sonia Sotomayor, writing in the outraged dissent joined by the court's other two liberals. In every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law. Dismissing those worries, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, argued that presidents stand apart from regular people, so protecting them from prosecution if they are accused of abusing their powers to commit official crimes is necessary. I'm going to need someone to explain that to me.
Well, there's a lawyer in the room.
Yes, that is good. Unlike anyone, he wrote, the president is a branch of government, and the Constitution vests in him sweeping powers and duties. He added, accounting for that reality, ensuring that the president may exercise those powers forcefully as the framers anticipated he would, does not place him above the law. It preserves the basic structure of the Constitution from which that law derives. But wait, this gets even more confusing. These dueling claims of what risk the founders meant the Constitution to guard against will take their place in the annals of a multi-generational argument over presidential partners. No president before Mr. Trump has been charged with committing crimes while president. That has raised the question of whether previous presidents were immune, and the Justice Department under President Biden broke a norm by allowing a special counsel to charge Mr. Trump, or whether it was just that most other presidents weren't criminals. After Richard Nixon resigned to avoid being impeached for his abuses of power and the Watergate scandal, his successor, Gerald Ford, shut down a criminal investigation into Nixon by pardoning him. The act was unpopular enough that it may have cost Ford the 1976 election. So there's a lot to talk about this morning, this public and private actions and what that means. There's a lot here. Three members of the Supreme Court's conservative supermajority, Chief Justice Roberts, Justices Clarence Thomas, and Samuel Alito, so three of the six who voted in favor, were Reagan administration lawyers. Two others, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, worked for the Bush administration and advanced a broad view of a president's exclusive constitutional powers, especially in the sort of national security matters that frequently arose after the terrorist attacks of September 11th. Only Justice Amy Coney Barrett, a former law professor, never worked as a lawyer for the executive branch. Notably, even as she joined the majority opinion, she issued a more restrained concurrence, siding with the dissent on whether prosecutors should be at least be able to tell juries about a president's official actions if they are relevant context for understanding official actions. You're right. Unofficial actions he is being prosecuted for. I'll read that line again. Siding with the dissent on whether prosecutors should be at least able to tell juries about a president's official actions if they are relevant context for understanding unofficial actions he is being prosecuted for. Heather Mulligan joins us. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. It's beautiful out.
Yeah, it is. Nice.
Can we go nice day to be in a studio.
Yeah, it's very nice. Welcome. Good morning. Would you like to start us off?
Sure. I wish I could lend any insight other than I'm very interested in sort of the what I think is the majority's, you know, sort of lockstep adherence to what they believe the founders intended. And I think you saw that with the overturning of Chevron also. Although, again, I don't think that that decision or this decision are wildly absurd. But I think that they are sort of a reflection of the swinging of the pendulum that happens when you change the composition of the court. I think that there's a lot to be said about immunity for actions taken when a person is the president of the United States. Certainly there were calls for prosecution of other presidents, and most specifically I remember calls for prosecution of Bush after 9/11 and, you know, the invasion based on what turned out to be incorrect information. So it makes sense to me that a president acting within his presidential capacity would have some immunity from acts that, if another person were to take them, may be viewed as criminal. You need to have that kind of authority to lead, and they rightly point out he is the head of an entire branch of government. And hopefully it'll be a she someday that is the head of an entire branch of government. But all that being said, there's a saying... And I'm probably going to get it wrong. And please, you know, if someone wants to correct me, fine, have at it. But it's bad facts make bad law. you can take a factual scenario where this strict application of the law seems to result in a nonsensical outcome. And to me, that's, you know, you saw that right away with the Trump's lawyers trying to immediately set aside the verdict in New York, which were not presidential acts. I'm sorry. There's no, I mean, because he was running for president, it's okay to.
Well, they're saying the checks were written while he was president.
But I think that's just so tenuous. I mean, I don't know how the checks being written after he gets elected, because he delayed in paying the guy in a timely manner that he somehow enjoys, you know, that doesn't make any sense to me. But again, bad facts make bad law. I doubt that they will set aside.
No, I doubt. I doubt they will too.
But it's fascinating, right? That you know, we've got these sort of strict constructionalists that are now dominating the Supreme Court, and you see what happens. There was an argument to be made that at the time that Roe, for example, was decided, that it was a large deviation from what was then the understanding of the Constitution and how the right to privacy applied, and that they were really going out on a limb. It stood for a very long period of time, but now there's this majority that is going back to strict constructionalists, and they are setting aside precedent and saying, no, this is what the Constitution says. This is what the framers intended. And so here's the outcome. And by the way, I think they went very much out of their way not to address the particulars of this case. They're saying in the abstract, this is what the rules ought to be.
So there was... I actually met Scalia once and heard him talk. I've heard other strict constructionists. You know, the problem is strict constructionism is equivalent to saying judicial activism pretending to be the framer's intent. So, for example, the Chevron is a much easier one to explain that, right? With the Chevron case, Congress passed a purposely broad law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, was the intention that would let the agencies make the decisions, or was the intention that, you know, judges would make the intention, right? Neither one of those is actually written in the law. So it becomes up to the judges in the Supreme Court to say, hey, you know, the Constitution doesn't explicitly say anything about this. We're going to interpret it this way because we think that's what the framers meant. Now, they could just as easily have said, we're going to interpret this other way, that breadth, right, was
but
in the Constitution,
I will say
too.
It's inconsistent with a lot of the thinking that, you know, even in New York, and New York's Constitution is a little better, I think, in terms of basically controlling the executive authority, although, you know, we've slid backwards too. But I would say this, I mean, there's been a tension historically where regulatory agencies interpret their authority as being much broader than any reasonable person would interpret it.
Right. But now they're saying that the president gets to tell
right.
the executive agencies what to do, despite the fact that my understanding of the Constitution, which I admit is not as a constitutional lawyer, says we have these three branches of the government. So when Congress does something, the president can't unilaterally decide, no, we're just not going to do that.
Right.
This gives the president not only extends his powers the way they've been extending his power, but also makes him immune to the legality of that. So in other words, obstruction suddenly becomes almost impossible to prove.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean,
seems like it can't possibly be what the framers intended, because the framers said explicitly, you know, George Washington got up and said, "Hey, thank God we're no longer kings. You know, I'm
right.
Mr. President. I'm not His Majesty." And,
right.
You know, I feel like this is the Supreme Court saying originalism doesn't include any of the amendments.
Well, you know, I
certainly
guess,
not the first time.
So, I mean, if you look at it in the context of the regulatory decision as well, they're saying, you know, the regulatory agencies are the province of the executive. It's the execution of the laws. If Congress wants to correct it, they can fix the law. They can clarify. They can direct. But then it begs the question, what happens when the agencies at the command of the executive don't obey or don't follow through on what they're being told to do? But this decision only extends to the right. president. It doesn't
well,
include...
And it also extends... some of my concern has been less the deference to a strong president. I don't like that. But the court which rallied heavily, a lot of these people on this court got there by saying we're against judicial activism, have given more and more power to the courts, and particularly to the Supreme Court, because now they become the ones who... So Congress passes a law. The president says we're going to do X. Congress comes back and says, hey, you know, we don't like X. It's now the Supreme Court who gets to say, well, X is or isn't constitutional. You know, if Congress passes a law, a national law either permitting or prohibiting abortion, you can see that going right back to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and, I think judicial activism is in the eye of the beholder. Right.
Yeah.
You know, is it activism to overturn 50 years of precedent? Arguably, yes. But their argument would be, well, no, it was the original decision was activism, and we're just correcting that. So, yeah. You know, there's some semantics involved. And I'm sorry, I'll be quiet for a minute.
Well, Mike Spain is a panelist on the show. We'll get to his views in just a moment. I promise we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll get to that. We also have a lot of letters, as I said early on, that, you know, when the mailbox is full, before you're through the first sentence, that things are going to be jumping. So that's the case this morning. We welcome your thoughts. We'll continue with Mike and more discussion after this short break.
And leaves our Irish setter red when fall comes to New England.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 2nd of July. Jim Hendler, Heather Mulligan weighing in on the news of the Supreme Court and their decision yesterday, leaving Mike Spain and his thoughts before we go to a lot of letters and more conversation on this subject. Go, Mike.
Yeah, I'll make it brief because I want to hear the letters. But the... The irony is that this decision by the court.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I know. That this decision comes just a couple days before we celebrate the 248th birthday of the United States, where the Declaration of Independence was officially issued. And really what that was a screed against the idea that a king could tell us what to do and absolute power would no longer reign over us. And it just feels like, not so much these days. I mean, I read as much as I could of Sonia Sotomayor's dissent. I read also that she read it out loud, took 24 minutes, which is unusual. But I applaud her for that. I think it was, I mean, she had so many good lines in that, and it's worth it. But the, I mean, I just can't believe that just about 4 or 5 days after the debate that was so disastrous for Biden, that seems like old news. And a lot has gone by since then. So many things have happened. It is perhaps one of the – I mean, this is reminiscent of what went on in August and late July of 1974, where one thing would happen, another thing would happen, another thing would happen.
Yeah.
And it's just unbelievable. And it doesn't seem to be anywhere near an end. So we're left with trying to analyze what exactly
this court ruling means, but we know one thing. It's really going to slow down, if not put the brakes on, the federal prosecution of Donald Trump for his role in the January 6th uprising. And there may be one little, you know, some legal analysts have written that there might be one light at the end of the tunnel in order to argue back before Judge Chunkin, is that how she pronounces her name, who handles the Washington-based case involving January 6th, where Trump has been charged. Prosecutors will have to reveal a lot of details that have never been detailed before in making their case that his actions were not official acts. And in the process, in the next several weeks and maybe next few months, if that comes out, one might think that could be hurtful to Trump, but he does seem to be, made out of, Teflon these days, and things don't stick to him. But it's a very uncertain time, and it's unsettling, and clarity is not in the offing.
And also, Mike, you know, the one of the things I heard, you know, part of the problem is there's still everybody's trying to interpret this thing. It's 130 pages long and full of. I was told there's some places where there may be considered inconsistencies depending on legal interpretation. But my understanding is Chunkin's court, that's not going to be made public because it could be official acts. So they're saying that will have to be something where the prosecutors report to her.
Right, have it in camera. Closed, it's in camera, so
yes,
closed courtroom.
Yeah.
Or in the judge's chambers.
It may still get out, but it's not going to be. Anyway.
Well, if she rules that that is compelling evidence, then perhaps that evidence would be become part of the record. But there's just so many. So many things happening at once it's going to take a little time to sort all this out exactly what it will mean. But I'm sure it will. I think everybody agrees that January 6th trial in Washington involving Trump ain't going to happen anytime soon. And if Trump is elected to another term, he'll have the authority clearly now, in case there was any question, to order the Justice Department just to end that whole process.
All right, let's go to the barrage of letters and continue our conversation on this Tuesday morning. We go to Robert. Regardless of who wins the election in November, Joe Biden has 6 months left in office. What legal presidential acts could he do to show just how bad this decision is? We have several letters like this. It was something that we actually talked about right before we went on the air.
Do they involve the term Navy SEALs?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I mean, the one thing he could do is, you know, he could have people donate money to whomever he likes in exchange for pardons. And that, I think, is pretty clear. I mean, a pardon is clearly an official act that is contemplated by this decision. The question is, you know, can he get paid?
And can he take it personally?
Right.
Not to his campaign, but yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So I was having this discussion with someone, I won't say it was my wife, who's far more progressive
so
than I am.
So clearly not your wife.
But
Someone other than your wife.
Okay, Jim.
But she. But no, my wife points out that, you know, the problem is, what this basically says is we trust the president to be an honorable person. And the Biden's biggest problem is he's an honorable person. So in the next 6 months, he's not going to take advantage of this. In fact, in part to show this contrast, and it's really too bad because he could do something to completely derail the Trump campaign.
Well, especially after last night and the strongest thing that he said in a week's time, which is I dissent. So.
Yeah.
I do. Can I just say one thing? It does point to the fact that we just need to do a better job at picking candidates, right? I mean, we really, really need to fix the Electoral College. Let the states weight the vote within the Electoral College. Everybody's vote will count. unlike the states where if you're an all-red state, doesn't matter. You know, if you're a Democrat, your vote doesn't count. If you're in an all-blue state, if you're a Republican, your vote doesn't count. That's not what was intended. If we could fix that and have everybody's vote count, I guarantee you we will end up with better candidates.
This goes along with the previous letter from Anne, but a bit more pointed. Does the Supreme Court's decision on presidential immunity mean that if Biden is reelected, he can overrule this decision and presidential powers can revert to the way they were 2 weeks or 2 days ago? Then we go to this letter from Brad, with the horrific and seemingly unconstitutional ruling on presidential immunity, what is stopping the current president from exercising some of its breathtaking open-ended license to perform any quasi-nefarious activities? For instance, unilaterally declaring in an executive order that convicted felons are barred from running for any federal office, ooh, effective immediately? Hey, Joe, go for it. A lot of these letters have the same.
I like that one.
I think it'll immediately go to the Supreme Court, right? I mean, that's the problem.
Well, and the bizarre part will
they're
be
in
the
recess,
court
you
will
know.
Be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but the court would have to actually figure out its own rule.
Right, yeah.
So most of these letters all start off the same way. Yeah. Given this ruling, what's to prevent Biden from? And then the key to the letter is the idea that the letter writer then comes up with what Biden can do with this quote-unquote power. In this case from Teresa, given the ruling, what's to prevent Biden from imprisoning and even executing Trump for treason? Seems a bit harsh, but okay. Then we go to Chris. So can Biden now reverse the Chevron decision?
No.
Yeah. And we go to...
Could he direct, though, the Department of Environmental, EPA to... do things that they were doing under the law that the court said they didn't have the right to do under the law.
5 minutes later, you get an injunction. I mean, that's the problem. The legal system has the ability to stop activities.
Trials of candidates.
So you can only be king for a day?
Well, or even less, depending on how long it takes a bunch of lawyers to slap
an
injunction.
You just need to be a dictator for a day and it's all taken care of, John.
But I just want to say something. As far as the idea, could you imprison Trump? Could you declare felons? The underlying problem with that is, whether or not that's within the rules, whether or not that's the new framework that we're all operating under, it is so divisive. It will cause a civil war. It would split the country more than it is already. And I actually have faith that Joe Biden has a better character. Yeah, he would never want to do that. We don't.
That's what Jim was saying.
Right. Yeah.
Jim's wife was saying, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So, back to my point, we need better candidates, not. And I'm only referring to one of them in this case, so.
Richard says, six cowardly, corrupt scoundrels in the tank for a felon. They seem not to have scraped bottom even now. There is a heritage. This is a Heritage Foundation fever dream. Burn SCOTUS down, writes Richard.
Hey, if Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas had recused themselves, as they really should have, they still would have been a 4-3 decision in favor of this. So,
Rita says, is there any way this ruling can be reversed or modified? Well,
nope.
It goes to the lower courts, be interpreted, and then...
Right. It's going to bounce around. It'll go down. It'll come back up. If they think that the lower court made the right decision, they just will decline to hear the case.
And that'll be the way it is.
Yeah. But there's no forum to appeal the Supreme Court's ruling on something. The way that you fix a Supreme Court decision that you don't agree with is you amend the Constitution.
Fairly trivial operation.
Or you bring it up 50 years later and let them vote again.
Right. Or you change the composition of the court. So, yeah.
Well, to be fair, right, there have been times where the court has changed a very longstanding
precedent, like 2 years ago, I think.
I'm saying in a positive way. I mean, Dred Scott, right? And some of these. So I'm not totally opposed to a court saying, hey, the world has changed. we can reconsider something. What I do find bizarre is the court saying the world has changed. We can go back to a decision that was made and decide it was just plain wrong. Right. Those are very different. In other words, they didn't say there's new reasons to change things.
But you're getting to the divide between judicial philosophies, right? There are the so-called liberal, which tend to be appointed by Democrats, but not always. Right. And then there's the conservative, tend to be appointed by Republicans, but not always. The difference conservative and liberal in those contexts is not what we think of in politics, but is it a liberal interpretation of the words of the Constitution or a conservative textualist interpretation? And what we're seeing now is sort of the textualists versus the people who say the Constitution is a living, breathing document and you have to interpret it at the, you know, in the understanding of the times that we're in. That's a debate that goes back to the beginning, right? It's not new.
There was no internet back then. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, yeah, things are accelerated now. Information
airplanes.
Is, yeah.
We'll get to that discussion.
Right.
Yeah.
No airplanes
yeah, we'll get
back
to the...
then.
Right, right.
All right.
I was just saying, immunity was the second worst thing.
Why is your mic is not on? There you go. Go ahead.
I was going to say immunity is possibly the second worst thing the Supreme Court did yesterday.
Well, we have much more to discuss, and we'll do exactly that. We're going to take a break, and we'll continue. Have a few more letters. We'll move on to topics, and that should take us into the next hour. We'll be back right after this.
And give myself as truly as an arrow flies in windless skies. Oh, I remember you in the tears.
Listening to the music of Cheryl Wheeler this morning, playing the Town Crier Cafe in Beacon, New York, on the 6th of July. You can find out more about that performance by going to Town Crier. That's town spelled with an E, TOWNECRIER, towncrier.com. You can also see all of the music listed on our website, the bumper music that we play during the program and throughout the day. WAMC.org/roundtable. All right. Let's go back to some letters and our conversation on the Supreme Court decision regarding immunity yesterday. We go to Adrian. Constitutional originalism is a crock of baloney. Before Scalia, it was a fringe idea, and that is where it belongs. Let's divorce the law from its modern context, try to read the minds of a bunch of dead white men in order to infer their intentions, and not even remotely consider the health and welfare of society and its laws are supposedly meant to protect. I'm sure this will yield fantastic results. The agenda of the conservative majority on the court is to allot power to corporate and religious franchises and insulate them from regulation that serves the public good. That from Adrian. Then we go to T.
You know, an interesting test of that would be what happens when the Louisiana Ten Commandments law gets to the Supreme Court next year, because it's certainly going to move up quick.
Yeah. I don't think they're going to let that stand.
It's a historical document.
Well, okay, but...
T writes, Ms. Mulligan's exaggerated characterizations about the Chevron doctrine case are unfortunately misleading. Chevron never supported agencies taking obliviously wrong positions. It instead recognized the scientific and regulatory knowledge that agencies bring to the table, contrary to the opinion. I, for one, do not believe courts are better at applying science under regulatory statutes than sophisticated agencies.
Nor do I, and I did not at all say that the courts should be the finder of fact as far as what regulatory authority is. My point was there has historically been a tension between the regulatory agencies and the breadth and the activism with which they applied their legislative authority.
Let's go to Bo, who says, "Why is it assumed that the Why is it assumed that the Supreme Court decision will necessarily delay any trial of Trump for his role in the January 6th assault on Congress?" Well, it has to go a lot of battling of figuring out what is private and public. And
that'll be appealed.
And that'll be appealed.
The court isn't going to be back in session till October, so it won't be resolved. And I think that will just delay it past November.
And there's and you're not going to have a full trial beyond that before.
No.
Before the beginning of November.
No way. No, it does. It clearly kicks that one down the road.
President Biden said that in his remarks, in the first few minutes of his remarks, that there's no way this is going to be decided before the election.
And I guess this would also affect anything going on in Georgia, in Atlanta, right?
Potentially. I also think it just kind of highlights the fact that the delay in bringing these prosecutions was a mistake. I mean, I think that there was probably some calculation maybe there was a thought that he wouldn't run again. I don't know, but I don't think that was realistic ever. But the delay in bringing these prosecutions, to time them better, closer to the potential election, it was a mistake. Whatever the reason was, the delay was a mistake.
I think they were afraid of it looking like, right after Biden's elected, we're going to pounce on Trump.
Right.
And there was briefly, after January 6th, there was a belief that that Trump was washed up.
Right.
And even his supporters, many of his supporters would pull away, and that just did not happen. But it's, the funny thing is Mitch McConnell blocked the impeachment of Trump over January 6th because he said, he'll be held accountable by the public courts. And wrong.
All right. So a couple of things, ripple effects to this decision. Heather mentioned this momentarily, but I would like to just dig into it for a little bit. It took about, a nanosecond after the Supreme Court's decision before the Trump camp moved to overturn the Manhattan conviction, citing the immunity decision. And this does get murky. Donald Trump began in an effort on Monday to throw out his recent criminal conviction in Manhattan and postpone his upcoming sentencing, citing a new Supreme Court ruling that granted him broad immunity from prosecution for official actions he took as president, according to a person with knowledge of the matter. So they sent a letter to the judge overseeing the case. Mr. Trump's lawyers sought permission to file a motion to set aside the verdict, doing so just hours after the Supreme Court issued its ruling. The letter will not be public until Tuesday at the earliest, after which prosecutors will have a chance to respond. The move from Mr. Trump's lawyers came 10 days before the judge was set to sentence the former president for his crimes in Manhattan. That's still scheduled as of now for July 11th. That is where a jury convicted him on 34 felony counts related to his cover-up of the sex scandal in the run-up of the 2016 election. The effort to set aside the conviction might be a long shot. The Manhattan case centers on acts Mr. Trump took as a candidate, not a president. However, his lawyers are likely to argue that prosecutors built their case partly on evidence from his time in the White House. And under the Supreme Court's new ruling, prosecutors not only may not charge a president for any official acts, but also cannot cite evidence involving official acts to bolster other accusations. And this is where it just gets slightly weird. Mr. Trump's efforts appeared to cause at least a brief interruption. The district attorney's office did not on Monday make a sentencing recommendation to the judge about whether to imprison Mr. Trump, as was expected, and a spokeswoman for the district attorney's office declined to comment.
Yeah, it's weird. Exactly. It sounds like they're at least considering what impact it will have on the whole process. But the prosecutors in the New York case were expected to come out this morning. I don't know if they have yet, with some kind of reaction to the Trump filing yesterday, and maybe respond to that. But it is just very strange. One of the terms that never comes up in the discussion of this that I've heard is they keep talking about official conduct. What about official misconduct? Can a president be held accountable for official misconduct?
That sounds like no.
No, yeah. Apparently not.
Yeah,
no.
I mean, I think that, and you know, there's
only by impeachment.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of sort of parallels at the state level. There's executive privilege, that acts that you take in your official capacity. If you're sued over them, you're entitled to representation at the taxpayer's expense. And, you know, those are all sort of extensions of a similar concept. The thing that I have a lot of trouble with in this decision is the idea that if in your official role you undertake an act while you're sitting in office, okay, you'll undertake an act that is clearly illegal. Murdering someone, for example. Let's say, like,
taking a bribe.
You murder the first lady, right? Yeah. You murder the first lady.
Let's just use an exaggeration.
Oh, don't give Trump ideas.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm saying the bad facts. Think about, like, the most absurd extension.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Right? And that's why bad facts make bad law, like I said. But you murder the first lady, and your defense is, well, she was going to reveal that I had, you know, done something else which would undermine the presidency in some way, or she was going to, spill the beans about some defense secret or something else. So therefore, I murdered her in my official capacity. I'm like, what do you do with that? Right? I can't believe that would ever be the case, that person would enjoy immunity. But, you know, it's if the evidence can't even be discussed because it's in your official capacity in some way, you know, I just don't know. It's a little scary.
A little.
Just a little. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss, and we'll do just that on the program this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this break.
Now I'm down and dropping still, and this snow's blowing through.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Jim Henler, Heather Mulligan, and Mike Spain make up the panel. We welcome you to join in on the discussion. We're certainly not going to run out of things to talk about this morning. We may run out of time. So I'm going to move through this and different issues, and we'll go back and get letters on all these topics in just a little bit. I do want to talk about what happened, what's been happening over the last 48 hours in regards to the decision or the thought of whether Biden should be replaced, and that debate that rages on. And the headline in the Washington Post is Biden team courts skittish Democrats as the path to replace him narrows. That's an interesting interpretation. I think if you look at who the Biden campaign folks are talking to, the very, very early flash polls that were taken that don't show that much change, and also phone calls that are being made with large donors, seem to be putting some of it on at least temporary hold. However, that does not mean that there are not members of the Democratic Party and the Democratic establishment and the Democratic elite, if you will, who are calling for the President of the United States to step aside in running for president for a second term. And that continues. And it's also been said that the Biden campaign isn't helping itself any by writing letters that are referring to people who are, quote unquote, pearl clutching, calling them bedwetters. So the idea that it's pushed aside as a bad 90 minutes and it was a blip and it was just a a momentary thing that will quickly go away does seem to me to be a ignoring something that is perhaps much larger or is much larger. But you do see in the press, some in the media, as Ira would ask me to say, that there's the story of this is like we've stopped the bleeding. Mm. And then, however, these people are really angry and they're still calling for changes. And this is what we would like to see. Biden's senior advisors ramped up efforts to soothe skittish Democrats on Monday, placing a flurry of calls to lawmakers, contacting donors, and circulating an internal poll suggesting he had not lost ground after his much-criticized debate performance. At the same time, party officials finalized a timeline to formally nominate Biden within weeks, a move that could limit talk of alternative candidates, so giving them a smaller window to have the discussions that would be necessary to replace him as the candidate. Taken together, the actions by the small circle of Biden's most loyal advisors were meant to reemphasize that the president has no plans to exit the race, despite calls from a range of allies who worry he cannot recover from last week's debate performance, which at times created an image of a raspy-voiced elderly man who struggled to complete a thought. Meanwhile, there are other Democrats who are in that camp of saying that they're with the president for the moment, but are also waiting for more concrete polling and to see what true numbers come out in the days and weeks to come. As mentioned before, there is not a lot of time for Democrats to do something. And it is it's also fascinating, I think, at least I find this fascinating, that with all of this said, with all of this talked about, that he didn't take questions last night. He had an opportunity to take questions last night when he spoke. He didn't take questions last night. He has a very light schedule this week. I think there's one public event. And we've been hearing that they're going to put him out. Do an interview, do a live interview with a journalist. Jake Tapper yesterday on his show said, pick me, please pick me, please, please, please pick me. Which I'm sure a lot of other journalists are saying too. However, that isn't happening yet. And that also makes me wonder sort of what's going on there.
I just don't think you can put this genie back in the bottle. I really don't.
You can't unsee it.
Right. You can't unsee it. And by the way, if he stays on the ticket, the campaign ads are going to write themselves. Pick him debating.
Well, they've already started, right?
Right. So, I mean, pick him debating 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and put it as a side-by-side with the debacle that happened last week. And the confidence is not going to be there. You can't. You know, I think it was the Post yesterday that said his staff is someone on his staff kind of said, look, between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., he's really good. Well, president is 24/7. You know, I mean, it's not people do not want to have someone who's not capable running the country. Now, I say that without referencing his opponent, but I think if he stays on the ticket, I mean, game, set, match. I just don't see him recovering from this.
One of the things that seems to really take two. One of the things that is bothering me a lot in what they're saying is the surrogates. When the surrogates get on the cable news shows and the news shows, and they talk to the press, and they say, "Well, the Biden we need is this Biden, and the Biden we want is this Biden." The Biden that we saw here, we saw at that time, on that day, at this time of day, is the Biden that we want. Well, to me, that's a special order at a restaurant, right? I mean, that's
right.
that's not, we need a president. No, we need somebody who, all the qualifiers that have to take place. And to me, that just sort of really epitomizes the actual issue of, okay, that's a problem. Like, if we have to start picking as to what kind of Joe Biden we want.
Well, I mean, anyone.
With Trump, we know what we're going to get.
Anyone who's had, you know, the heartbreak of a relative who has had a decline, sometimes recognizes you, sometimes doesn't. You would never say, I'm going to cross my fingers and hope this person is okay most of the time. They can continue to live on their own, drive, do everything else, because sometimes they're okay. I mean, that's, to me, that's what this sounds like.
Okay,
it's
wait.
Exaggeration.
Yeah.
He's not quite there.
No, I'm using it as
quite.
A parallel.
No,
I'm not
I
saying
understand.
He doesn't know where he is, but I'm saying the fact that he's not 100% there all the time.
Yeah, I mean,
he's president. It's not.
First of all, okay. There's this notion somehow that the president just sits there alone in his office and makes decisions, right? The president is surrounded by a team. The president, the Biden team has been, you know, one of the things Trump accuses him of is not firing anyone. Well,
yeah.
He hasn't fired anyone because he brought in good people who he's listening to.
Yeah,
and who
that,
are doing
that's
good
Trump
things.
Saying, I fire I mean, people all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I look at that. I went back to that debate and said, let me just cover over the Biden half of the screen. Right. I wish there was a lot more commentary on the fact that not a single word that Trump spoke was something that hadn't come from some weird right-wing conspiracy theory. So the stuff about Pelosi's daughter released a thing that said Pelosi took full credit for Jen. What? Okay, so you go back and you find this teeny tiny clip in this thing that I forgot which of the.
And I'm not saying Trump.
Right.
Trump is qualified.
No.
I don't think he is.
I agree with you, but what I'm saying is, so I don't see that the Democrats have a choice right now, because who could you put up quickly?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know how you do it. But I don't think. But I also haven't closed the door in my brain on the argument of doing it, because this idea, it just seems to me that you can say that this person is an existential threat, this person is a threat to democracy, this person is going to ruin our country, and by the way, and we should take it so seriously that we're going to put up someone who can't answer those charges on stage in the moment when you were prepped for a week to do exactly that. Mike Spain.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think there's two words that come to mind as you were making your comments earlier, Joe, and reading from this Washington Post story, and that is there's denial, and certainly there's a lot of that going on at the very high level of the campaign, the Biden campaign, but there's also some real arrogance here in the Democratic Party. The fact that that whole kerfuffle where they had to get around Michigan's rules that you establish a candidate by a certain date, and their convention was happening later, and he might not be on the ballot in Michigan. So they were all going to get together on a Zoom call, I guess, on August 5th, the key Democratic people, and they're going to officially name him the Democratic nominee. Well, that's been fixed. Michigan has is not going to press that, and he can be on the ballot if he's nominated later in August, and it goes away. They're still going to meet on August 5th and do that. That smacks to me like the way Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party rolled their way into the nomination back in 2016 and pushed out Bernie Sanders and pushed out other competitors, and I think it's going to backfire, and you're going to end up with a candidate with people asking exactly what you just asked. There has to be some reckoning. And if his polls don't, if it is true that the polls have not changed really materially since Thursday night's debate, it's because he was already so low that he wasn't
so,
getting any
well,
so there were.
I'm sorry. Let me just answer that real quick. But this also gets into what I think what the New York Times was saying in their editorial when they were calling for him to step aside over the weekend with the editorial board. They said exactly what I think a lot of Democrats are saying. We believe that there should be a change made. However, if he stays in the race, we are going to vote for him because we are not going to vote for Donald Trump. And I think, so if you're not seeing a huge change in the polls, it's that reason, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's exactly. The reason.
And, you know, I was going to say, several of the, you know, I mean, it's all anecdotal, but several of the focus groups on both the right wing and the left wing kind of media talking right after the debate, strangely, they all commented on his behavior, but not a single person said it changed their mind, with one exception, which was one person who was undecided who said, listening to Trump lie like that, I can't vote for him. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to vote for Biden, but that's a Trump lost a voter there. So, you know, I think people have been so focused on Biden's performance that, and what the polls are going to tell us is, what does the middle think about Trump's behavior? Because frankly, you know, right after the debate, I think if someone had asked me, should we replace Biden, I'd probably said yes. I think after sleeping on it for a weekend, my answer is probably no, because there's so much time between now and the election. There's so many different things that are going to happen, and there's so many of them that can outweigh a debate, like what happens on July 11th if Trump does or doesn't get,
I have to say, I think like if you step back and you look at people, there is a percentage of people that are going to vote for Trump no matter what.
Right.
30%, 32%, give or take. His negatives are, negatives are very, very high. Yeah. There's a certain percentage of people that are going to vote for Biden no matter what. And then there's the rest of the people. There's the independents. There are the swing voters. There's the double haters, you know.
Which they were saying 6 to 7% yesterday. I don't know if that number is accurate.
I can't believe that number is accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, my little focus group of college kids, siblings who are apolitical, who lean left, none of them after that would have voted for Biden. I think you put any other Democrat, and there's no way they're probably just not going to vote, right? That's the end of the story. They're just not going to vote. So if you have, you know, you put, I don't know, Whitmer Booker on a ticket, you put, you know, they would vote for them. They're not going to vote for Biden. They're not going to vote for Trump.
But there's a lot in the middle who I don't think would vote for, you know, Whitman Booker or Newsom, whoever, right? The problem is, you have this very, very, very small group of voters who are going to determine this stupid election. Drives me up a wall, but it's five states, it's 2%, it's, you know, as you said, the real problem is the Electoral College, the real problem mm-hmm. is the way things work.
Yep.
North and South Dakota, which together have less people in them than, I think, 48 other states, get six electoral votes right. because they're two states. I mean, it's an insane system. But when you look, you know, so I think the real question becomes, is there someone you could put? I think current Democrats will say, there's no choice. I have to vote for him. I think some of the younger people, some of the middle people, some of these things, when push comes to shove, either it wouldn't matter who was running or that unless some kind of tidal wave, super charismatic person could be found overnight, and I don't see anyone.
I don't agree because I think that the key factor here is the negatives, right? The people who dislike Trump. If you gave them an option that they could get behind, they will vote. You know, don't let him become president again. They're not going to vote. A lot of them are not going to vote for Biden because they don't think. First off, they're not happy in their lives right now, but also so they want to change, but they don't think after this performance that he's capable of serving another term. And so I think you have to, and by the way, we have so many razor thin elections, right? Six counties are deciding this. It's a very small number of people in the country that are deciding this. I think you could shift that dynamic if you put a viable candidate on the Democratic ticket.
So here's my, I got a very nice letter, a very nice mean letter yesterday from a listener who was taking me to task for seeming to indicate that I thought that Joe Biden should be replaced. I don't know. I really don't know. In the end, I think we should discuss it. And someone on the panel said arrogance. The arrogance of the Biden team right now of putting everybody aside is, and of the family.
Oh, it's palpable.
At very least, we need to discuss this, and we have to talk about it, and we have to figure out what's right. With that said, knowing a history of the Democratic Party, do I think they're going to be able to get their act together in a matter of weeks to coalesce around one person?
Nope.
No, absolutely not. I don't believe that at all. I find that really, really hard to believe. I go back to George W. Bush. Republicans rallied around him, and he was the candidate in a nanosecond. Democrats don't do that.
No, that's the old adage. You know, I don't belong to an organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
That's,
you know,
right. So I don't think that's going to happen at all. But the other thing that keeps floating through my brain is, we are reacting to what happened Thursday night. That's all we're reacting to, yes, is what happened Thursday night. And the campaign keeps on telling us it's a blip. And all I'm going to ask is, what happens if we have another blip?
Right.
And what happens if we have another two blip or a three blip? And also, in fairness, what if it isn't really a blip, but it seems like a blip?
Well,
you know, it's been said that Biden is capable of being a good president, and he's brought in good people, as you pointed out, Jim, and he's got wisdom, and it has guided his presidency. You can argue whether you like that or not, but he has maintained a steady presidency that has worked towards goals that he had established when he became president. But he's not capable of running a very good campaign, and certainly isn't capable of doing both at the same time. That was pointed out much earlier than Thursday, and it just came to fruition Thursday. He evidently can't do both, and that's tough to reckon with.
And the argument, you know, if the argument is, hey, he's got great staff, he's got capable staff, I mean, the response to that is they're not elected, right?
That's right.
They can change.
But that's not the thing in my mind. Okay, look, you know, if you were to just simply look at numbers. I'm a numbers geek, right? I mean, you look at employment, you look at the stock market, you look at all the things that people have been saying forever is what matters to them. They're incredibly in Biden's favor. The price of gas at the gas pump is what's, you know, causing people to say inflation is killing me. It's lower than it was, you know, 3-4 years ago. I mean, there's just this sort of insanity of, it's all personality. And Biden has proven that he can run a country, right? Biden has rebuilt the trust of Europe in the United States. Built, you know, everything Trump said about you made us, you know, anathema to the rest of the world. Are you kidding? I mean, Trump made America so untrusted. Biden makes it trusted. And especially when we see things like what's going on in France, what's going on in other places where authoritarianism is taking over, you know, all of those places, they hold up Biden as a good example. They're not saying he's a tired old man. They're saying, look at a guy who's a real Democrat.
Right. I was in Tunisia during the Reagan administration, and when I was there, I would say the sentiment in Europe, in North Africa, was, God, we miss Carter. We loved Carter. Why didn't you reelect Carter? The rest of the world's view on who the president is not reflective of the populace. And, you know, honestly, all the numbers being good, the campaign has failed to make that front of mind. And you only need to say immigration, inflation, and crime, and you're, you know, basically you know, you set yourself back. But before the debate, he was not winning. Let's keep
that's
that.
Right.
You know, he was
right.
not winning right. before the debate.
No.
So
he was
not winning
about a tie, but he was
right.
in the back.
He was
the
tied
dark,
in one
of
the six
yeah.
states and losing in the others.
But within the margin
yes,
of error.
And
right.
yes, within the margin of error. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up. We have many letters too. I want to get to those. And I'm sure we can find other things to discuss as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Jim Henler, Heather Mulligan, Mike Spain. We'll continue our conversation after news from the BBC.
In the year of the yellow cap, shadow of the Great World War. Third kid, Grandma.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our feisty panel discussion for this second day of July. Jim Henler, Mike Spain, and Heather Mulligan. Let's go to letters, get to as many as we can in the time we have remaining. Leslie says, it amazes me how no one in the panel has mentioned Kamala Harris in this discussion. What happens to her and her support in the Black Asian female community? Well, in fairness, I don't think we really today have mentioned any candidates. I think we earlier brought up Gavin Newsom maybe a little bit, but we have discussed Kamala Harris. We've discussed so many different candidates, certainly not off the table. I think there's a huge obstacle before we start talking about candidates, and that is Joe Biden deciding whether he is going. It's up to him. It's his decision. Is he going to step aside and leave the race? So I understand the point of the letter, of course, but that's really when we need to have it. Is when the president, right.
Well,
if the president decides to step aside.
I would say though that the to this letter writer, right. Currently, if Biden does not step aside, Kamala remains the vice president and possibly even a stronger vice president if people are worried about, Biden making it to the end of his term. So, you know, I think that people are not talking that much about her specifically because essentially she's already on the ticket.
I think also because Trump has not named his VP,
yeah.
right? Because there's always the parallel conversation and the comparison. And I think, I thought we were going to find out last weekend. And I think because of the debate, they may be slow walking to see what,
yeah.
you know, who is he really going to be running against? If Biden is not on the ticket, you know, maybe that changes the calculation as to who your VP is.
Frankly, I think Trump's going to wait as long as possible
yeah.
because
okay.
he sees the suspense leads to headlines, and anything that leads to headlines makes him happy.
Many of the pundits, and that's what they are, some journalists and some commentators, are saying it's almost impossible to consider other than Harris if Biden were to step aside because it would be the least disruptive, and it would be an enormous insult and slap to women, to the African American community, to the minority community, and that she would make the strongest, if not strong, she would make the strongest person to replace him on the ticket. It would be the most logical, smoothest way to do it.
Dave writes a slightly nuanced letter from what we're talking about, which says those calling for Biden to step aside have no faith in Harris to take the reins if he becomes incapacitated. And I don't know if that's necessarily what they're saying. I think it more has to do with the president becoming or is the president incapacitated.
Right.
I think that's more of the question.
Are we
ceding the election? I mean,
right.
I think that's why we're waiting for funding numbers and poll numbers. And it was very telling that the campaign put out a statement saying that they'd done internal
yeah,
polling
right.
showing that the numbers hadn't changed. By the way, the numbers hadn't changed, and they still showed him losing.
Right.
They did not show him winning.
Yeah, it's hard to know how to go up from here.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you wonder about the, Well, we do have the 25th Amendment to the Constitution that allows members of the cabinet to remove a president if they see him unable to fulfill his responsibilities. And you know, purportedly that even was considered during the last days of Trump by some of his cabinet members. But that's not assuring.
Well, no.
And I was going to say, the other thing is, you know, you know, we know during the Reagan administration that the last couple of years of Reagan's administration, he was not the decision maker in a lot of stuff. I'm avoiding saying that he had Alzheimer's because there's debate over whether it was actually Alzheimer's or not. But he certainly showed dementia. So they basically just kept him quiet and, you know,
I mean, if
a lot
something,
of other people got involved.
If something were to happen, let's say, you know, stays on the ticket, has a, you know, miraculous surge in the polls, wins the election in November, but before he's sworn in January, he becomes incapacitated, can't serve. Because he hasn't been sworn yet and she hasn't been sworn yet as vice president, I believe it goes to Congress, and it's the incoming Congress. Yes, and so that's a complete, like, who knows
well,
what's going to happen.
What that will be.
Right, right. So, I mean, that's another risk that's out there.
I think that's a pretty long shot,
maybe.
An interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I'm sorry. It's just
kind of fun,
like, it's a scenario.
Out the scenarios.
Yeah.
We got a, I mentioned this yesterday on the show, that I was listening to Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz from Florida, a Democrat, and she was saying that she just felt that the people, she went back to her district over the weekend and nobody was even talking about the debate performance. They were just talking about Trump. No one was saying about how Biden did. Well, I don't know where she was at, but anywhere I went, still, that is awesome. Anybody.
She's wants so insanely partisan.
Talk about.
I mean, that came out in
but,
Hillary.
But I think this. Yeah. I think this is. You know, this is what I worry about with the, sort of again using the word, and I use it less loosely in this case, or more loosely in this case, of arrogance, of just nobody's talking about it. No, you have to realize, everyone is talking about it.
Do you think there's a scenario in your mind, Joe, or anybody in your mind, that could reverse this for Biden? What does he need to do right now to mitigate this?
I think he could go on Jeopardy, win the whole show.
That's a good one.
And he still wouldn't. I think he still. I mean, I think you still have this recorded performance that can be played over and over.
How about
again.
A medical expert explaining it?
My answer to you, though, Mike, is my honest answer to you is I was starting to turn yesterday, and then when the schedule comes out and they're not, we're going to put him on an interview. We're not going to put him on an interview. We're going to have him answer questions live.
Like a town hall.
We didn't have him answer questions live last night. We're going to have him do barnstorm the country. Well, he's not doing that. He's staying in Delaware.
Taking it quiet.
I don't know. I mean, there's a reason that's being done.
I thought he should go on Fox News.
So
I think he should go on 60 Minutes. I think he should go on with Jake Tapper. I think he needs to. And the reason he's not is because his handlers do not feel that he could succeed.
So what was our top story today? What did we discuss for the first hour and quarter?
Supreme Court.
I forgot.
That's what I'm saying. In other words, you know, I actually think part of what's happening here is that with a lot of other news happening quickly and then July 11th, I think the Biden campaign is sitting there. They're going to be doing the numbering, the polling, all that stuff. And, you know, the internal polls they use are very different than what we see. But I think what's really going to be the big thing is, what does it look like by sort of mid to late July, when this is, quote, behind us, unquote, when you know, you've had the Supreme Court ruling. You'll have whatever happens on July 11th, assuming anything happens on July 11th. So, you know, the felony conviction and the appeal. And, I mean, there's just so much news that's going to be happening over the next couple months that, yes, I agree this is a problem, but I'm not sure that changing things
fixes.
You get someone new. You get someone new in who can't get on into the headlines because of all this other stuff going on. I'm not sure that person's that much better off.
Amy,
so I don't know. I just don't know.
Amy writes, the president was just made king yesterday. The choice is between a tyrant and a person who is clearly able to do the job as he has been doing the job. Yes, he stumbled, but it wouldn't have mattered even if he showed up asleep in a wheelchair. The choice is still between a tyrant and a person who has been doing the job and doing the job well. This is a no-brainer, and this debate shouldn't change that.
Frankly,
if it does, that says more about the electorate than it does about either of these candidates. But it's all about winning. It's who can bring out it, and is Trump a pathological liar? Yes. But does he have 40 whatever
charisma
percent of people behind him?
Perhaps.
Yes. Yeah. And are they willing to change? Not yet.
Yeah, you know, it's often said that the president isn't the president. It's you know, it's Ronald Reagan Incorporated, it's Bill Clinton Incorporated, it's Joe Biden Incorporated. It's the team that he has, and the team has been doing a good job. They aren't elected. I know that's a fact, but if he puts a team in place, it can make things continue to work well, and it can deal with crises as long as he's mostly there.
So, like, a Wizard of Oz thing?
Kind
of.
Yeah, the man behind the mirror, pulling all his handles.
You know, there's a lot of brand damage that got done to the team.
You're right.
And
yeah.
I understand, you know, if there's a certain amount of people who pay attention to everything, who pay attention to the Supreme Court, who pay attention to what's going on with all these cases. I think the vast majority of people who are the undecideds have tuned most of that out. And they're looking big picture. But they tuned into the debate. And what they saw did not weigh in Biden's favor. I mean, it was a huge number of people who watched the debate.
Yeah, but it's also unclear whether it weighed in Trump's favor.
Million.
I mean, what it did is it weighed against both of them. And that's
well,
part
but
of what's
the,
right.
The post-debate
I mean,
polling,
knew.
Everyone, I mean, it was
changed.
Overwhelmingly.
Everybody agreed Biden lost the debate.
Right.
I don't
right.
argue that at all. But what I'm saying is, again, the numbers and the immediate numbers are really hard to tell. But the fact that there wasn't a big change in the immediate numbers, and, you know, it does point out that that could be because they were already low enough. But again, it's just it just seems to me it's too complicated. It's too late to do anything unless there was an absolute natural waiting.
My view is if the ticket remains the ticket, they are going to lose. I think. I mean, that's
now. Having said that, is there a ticket that could win?
Yes, I do. I think so. Yeah, I think there's
Corey,
there's a lot of tickets that could win primarily because Trump is such a bad candidate, right? And if you have the right team, and it becomes a choice between two. People,
but Democrats would have to unite behind this.
Absolutely, they would have to.
If there's like visible, massive disagreement, it's not going to be. It's going to be like Chicago in '68.
Right, right. I mean, you couldn't do like you couldn't do Newsom Harris or Harris Newsom because that's California, and I mean that's not gonna carry him over the finish line. But I mean, if you did like a Whitmer, and I mentioned Cory Booker, and maybe Harris is U.S. Attorney General under that administration, and I mean, I think that you pull back.
They better do it quick.
Yeah,
Harris
yeah, but I think
Whitmer
you could pull back a lot of.
That's
people.
A pretty good one.
Yeah,
I like Harris Whitmer. That's interesting.
All right.
Two women is tough.
It
you
is.
Know,
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
That's gonna be tough.
I have three letters that are all off out there, but I want to just we'll end with those three. Mary, Biden seemed like either he had been doped before the debate or that he was having a mini stroke. Trump has proven taste for diabolical drama. And Putin has an undying and lifelong lust for Ukraine and poisoning, so foul play does not seem to be out of the question to me. That is letter one. Letter two, Kamala must make the sacrifice and let Gavin Newsom run with Joe Biden And that is from Vern, who says the best remedy is to win. And then finally, we got this letter who said that. Oh, did I lose it? I may have lost it. I'm sorry. it was basically about here it is. From Bruce, who says, Trump's enablers have been called out. What about the enablers of Joe Biden?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Those are our three we will end with today. My thanks to everybody for being with us. We will return right after this.